This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Bureau County Emergency Management Director Keenan Campbell says drones are no longer just for hobbyists and recreation. They do serious work.
One of the local fire departments actually put their drone up to look at a fire from above to determine how it was spreading.
GLT's Ryan Denham also delves into drone use for tornado damage assessment. Plus, Mary Cullen talks with famed journalist Maria Hinojosa, musician and griot Che Kamaladiabate, talks about his tradition of African music and storytelling with John Norton, and ISU's Shelley Clevenger tells Mary Cullen about the ongoing stir among sexual assault victims and their families from the Kavanaugh hearings. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Drones are no longer a new or even emerging technology. They're a part of everyday life for insurance companies, photographers, law enforcement, and the military. And they're already saving lives in emergency response situations. That's according to Keenan Campbell. He's the director of the Bureau County Emergency Management Agency. Campbell's the keynote speaker at tomorrow's Drones in the Heartland conference at Heartland Community College in Normal. Campbell tells GLT's Ryan Denham, drones have another important tool in the emergency response toolbox.
We use it primarily for situational awareness. So if a tornado came through the county, the National Weather Service has given us pretty good data on where the storm hit, where the damage is, and the responders will obviously be paged by 911 based on who calls in. But after the fact, we want to look at the damage path, look at how much damage we have, and support the either we're going to do a disaster declaration or we're not, depending on the damage levels in the county. So it's primarily a situational awareness tool. The other side of it is missing, lost children, elderly patients that have wandered away from a long-term care facility, lost boaters on the river. A lot of times people don't exactly know where they are. So even with our E911 systems, they can triangulate the position, but they don't always have an area exact of where that person is calling from. So the drone has so much capability because it's faster than a fixed wing or a helicopter. Those traditionally take 1 to 2 hours to get in the air, where the drone could be in the air in 5 minutes.
What's your sense of how many county-level emergency management agencies and offices around the state are actually using drones at this point?
I think that number is fluid every day. Just in our region, we're broke up by Illinois Emergency Management Region. So in Region 2, there's 17 counties, and I know of at least 4 of the 17 that have drones. The other side of it is mutual aid, so we could be called from Bureau County to go to another call somewhere else to assist. So, I would say that the EMAs are getting on board with adoption, but you're probably at 20% statewide. There are some law enforcement agencies that are now embracing drone technology, as well as fire departments. I know down in Southern Illinois, there was, and it'll be in my breakout session presentation, but one of the local fire departments actually put their drone up to look at a fire from above to determine how it was spreading. It was a structure fire with buildings attached. On some of these older structures, you don't want to put firemen's lives at risk and you can't see. So with thermal imaging and things like that, they actually put the drone above the fire to concentrate where they were going to put suppression efforts at.
What are some of the barriers to more widespread adoption of drones in emergency management work?
Policy group has always been kind of a barrier. The FAA regulates drones just like they regulate all aircraft. Originally, anybody could purchase a drone, which you still can. Anybody can buy a drone, but the legality comes into play when you start flying it. We have a governing document that I wrote for our EMA that outlines when the drone can be used, when it shouldn't be used, different conditions, who has to be there. Most people think it's one guy. When we fly our drone, it's a minimum of 2, optimally 3 people, just to support the drone operations. We always have a pilot a volunteer observer, and then another person that could either be a visual line of sight observer or somebody. Because we have to maintain visual line of sight with the aircraft per the FAA rules. So people don't understand, the drone is a pretty small device. The lights are not that bright on it, but per the FAA, you have to be able to see the aircraft. Now, ours has a range of 3.2 miles from the controller. There's no way you could see the drone 3.2 miles away. The FAA, it kind of dropped on their lap. It was a new emerging technology. They've handled aircraft operations forever. But to bring these small UAS systems in place, I don't think they knew what they were in for when the technology started to mature. And now with the sub-$1,000 drones, anybody can purchase one. And I can't tell you how many times we have an operation and my phone starts ringing. Hey, I have a drone. I'd be glad to bring it out. Well, that's not what we do. I can't have private citizens flying drones on the county EMA's behalf.
What other barriers might there be to more widespread adoption?
You know, some of our elected officials, they're nervous or they're scared of the word drone. So generally when I speak about a drone, it's an SUAS. Small unmanned aerial vehicle. In our county, I presented it to our senior leadership and said, I believe this is a good tool. And obviously they were supportive of us testing this process. Some agencies are so scared about them that they don't want their EMAs or local police or fire or anybody to actually adopt them. So we really need to educate our policy group or our elected officials that they're not bad. You're not spying on somebody. We're not doing anything that could be construed as bad. It truly is just a tool, though. It's another tool in our toolbox for emergency management. If we can get it up in the air and get a bird's eye view on a search area, we're still using our ground search and rescue and all of our traditional resources. The drone is just one more tool to help them do their job.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham, speaking with Keenan Campbell, director of the Bureau County Emergency Management Agency. He'll be the keynote speaker at Friday's Drones in the Heartland Conference at Heartland Community College in Normal. Keenan, can drones make the job safer for those humans who are working in emergency response? I mean, can certain tasks simply be given to a drone instead, removing any risk of injury or death?
One example of how I know it can be safer, if you're on a ground search and rescue toward dark looking for a missing child, a ground search and rescue person is now in harm's way. Anytime you put them on the ground, they're exposed to the elements, be it heat, cold, trips, slips, falls, whatever it is. The drone can sometimes identify hazards, but what we use it for mostly during search and rescue is an exclusionary search. So what that means is we're covering a large amount of area to tell the searchers that person or that subject is not in this area. That doesn't mean that we can see every nook, cranny, crevice, things like that. We can't see everything with the drone. We're shielded by the canopy of the trees. It's not the same as a person on the ground. But if I can exclude an area, especially corn and bean fields, the drone excels at that, because a person walking through 6 foot tall corn takes a long time, where the drone can cover that area in a matter of minutes. And in my keynote or in my breakout session, you'll see video of kids that are out in the field. I found one child in 4 minutes, found the second child 2 minutes later. In that respect, just for a person on the ground to be exposed to the elements walking, it would have taken them hours to cover this same area that I did in minutes. So I would much rather put a couple $1,000 drone in harm's way than an officer that doesn't know what he's walking into.
The price point for kind of consumer or amateur grade drones has come down so much that, as you are hearing, obviously, from people out in the world, it's, you know, everybody's got one now. You can get one at Walmart off the shelf. What about the price point, though, for the types of drones that would be used by, you know, those in emergency response? Has that come down as well to the point where it's you know, less of a barrier than it maybe was 5 years ago?
Well, it depends on the platform. Our drone, we fly the DJI Phantom 3, so you can enter the market with one of those for, you know, $2,000 to $4,000. A partner in Region 2, Ogle County, has a Matrice, which is a much larger drone, and that's $25,000. But just the night vision alone for their drone was $12,000. So what I see is the technology is maturing, the price of components is coming down, whereas the FLIR and the night vision, those types of pieces of the drone are coming down in price. I feel like if an agency wants to get into the market, there is a model that would suit their needs.
That's GLT's Ryan Denham with Keenan Campbell, director of the Bureau County Emergency Management Agency. He'll be the keynote speaker at tomorrow's Drones in the Heartland Conference at Heartland Community College in Normal. Other breakout sessions at the conference focus on agriculture, regulations and safety, and educational practices, plus demos and tips for those taking certification tests.
Support for GLT comes from the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation, celebrating local philanthropy on November 15th with a workshop for nonprofits and a luncheon honoring Dwayne and Tony Farrington, the 2018 Philanthropists of the Year. Details at ilprairiecf.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, a West African griot with John Norton talking about that traditional musical tradition and storytelling as well. As President Donald Trump prepares the southern border for the arrival of a 3,000-person migrant caravan, journalist Maria Hinojosa says there's no need to fear. She keynoted last night's Latino cultural dinner at Illinois State University and spoke with GLT's Mary Cullen after her keynote presentation.
You began the night explaining how the two most, as you say, intimate parts of your life collided this summer. First, your immigrant story, and second, your rape when you were 16 years old. As a journalist, that's pretty much the epitome of living in your work. How do you handle being a journalist in this current time?
I realize that I have an important job as an American journalist. I realize that I am part of history. And so that always keeps me grounded, just kind of, you know, the work of the day to day and trusting my gut as an American journalist. But, you know, it is definitely a strange moment to feel that as a journalist, these two parts of yourself that are pretty intimate are now part of the public conversation, whether it's immigration or whether it's being a survivor of rape. And, you know, the downside is that it's just difficult to talk about some of these things. I would say the upside is that we are talking about these things, that we have come to a moment in our country where, you know, we are discussing things that we never thought we would. And there's a level of discomfort that comes with that. But as a journalist, I find that anything that is inspiring dialogue is ultimately good for the country. So it feels strange as a journalist to be a part of these two super important issues that are kind of at the center of our country. On the other hand, I realize that as a result, I have an even deeper responsibility to do this work and do it well.
Now, let me explain a little bit for our listeners and those who weren't at your speech tonight. Your immigration story, when you were young, your family immigrated into the U.S. and you were stopped in, I believe, Dallas. Is that correct?
Yep.
So you were stopped in Dallas and your family was stopped by TSA and you had three siblings with you, and your mother was asked to leave you in Dallas as the rest of your family moved up to Chicago, right?
Except for the TSA part, that was right, because there was no TSA back then. It would have been INS, Immigration and Naturalization Service. Yeah, they said that they wanted to put me into quarantine because I had a rash, and that I somehow was going to have to stay in the airport while the rest of my family moved on to Chicago. But what happened was that my mom had a moment where she basically stood up and defended her right to have her baby with her. And but what the story is that I could have been one of those children that was actually taken from their parents' arms by an immigration agent, and that would have been in the early 1960s. So to think that it was happening in the early 1960s and it's happening now, it was very strange to kind of come to that realization.
Now, regarding the story of your rape, you said that realization kind of came to you as Christine Blasey Ford's story came out just recently involving Judge Brett Kavanaugh, who is now in the Supreme Court. You also said that you do not personally like to consider yourself an activist. As a journalist, you say your job is telling the truth. So how do those collide for you as someone who's experienced those and you want to be an activist for yourself?
Right. So, I mean, I have to be honest with you. A very strange moment for me came at the end of the summer when suddenly I had no choice but to realize that actually calling myself a survivor was the appropriate term. And I really was in a state of shock because I was like, wait, what? I'm not a part of any group. You know, I mean, I'm an immigrant, so it's not like I choose to be a part of the immigrant community. I am an immigrant. To be a rape survivor and then suddenly as a journalist basically have to say, well, wow, I actually can use that term to refer to myself is very strange. But I understand that this is a moment in American history and that women are speaking up. And so I kind of see myself as part of a moment in American history. And because of the fact that I have a public voice and that as a result, I think I'm a little bit less fearful and have a lot less shame, that's why I decided to be much more public about this, because there was a lot of suffering that was going on with a lot of women who were coming to terms with things that had happened to them. And I wanted to be able to say, I'm right there with you, and we're going to be in this together, right? We're gonna figure out how to process this pain together. It's just that usually you're doing that work kind of with your therapist or with your partner, and here suddenly you're doing it in front of an entire country. And that's what I see my role as, at least in this particular moment, as a journalist, to be able to speak out and share my story in that particular moment. Yeah. I mean, I'm. It's weird because, like, I'm not a member of any survivors organization, and I'm not a member of any organization, but I am a survivor.
So you just spoke about that living in fear, and that's a big issue in our country right now, as we're talking about people, Americans who live in fear of immigrants, of, as President Trump is calling this, violent caravan coming into the country. And you spoke during your talk tonight about how we can address that fear and how actually the Midwest has been addressing that fear for a long time by instilling this thought of a melting pot. Can you get into that a little bit for our listeners?
Well, first of all, there's nothing to fear about what's happening today. The people who have been characterized as a terrorizing caravan of people are actually mostly women and children who are coming in the legal way to ask for refugee asylum cases. So, and those are not approved all at once. It's a long process. But I do think it's important to say there's nothing to be afraid of. Central America as a region has millions of people, and we're talking about, what, at this point, 1, 2, maybe 3,000, maybe 4,000 people. These are people who are living in the most desperate kind of situation to decide that the only way that they can come north is in a caravan where they're going to feel more protected because there's more than one or two people. So these are people who are desperate, desperate, desperate. And now we're seeing, you know, they've been categorized as some kind of a mob, but all of those stories of people who are traveling have individual human stories that the legal thing to do is to hear those stories of fear. And I like to talk about the Midwest because the state of Illinois, Chicago, where I grew up, central Illinois, right? These are not new issues. Migrants and immigrants, migrant workers or immigrants who are staying here have been a part of this area since forever. Since the time that there were indigenous communities here and settlers arrived, you know, this has been an area of a lot of multicultural and demographic change since forever. So when I say that the Midwest is an example, I mean it. I'm actually saying, look around at your particular city and say, you know, if you're not looking to be kind of taken down by this whole issue of fear, if you instead look at your community, if you drive around normal, if you're going into your supermarkets and your community centers, what do you see? You're probably actually seeing a lot of people getting along together and figuring life out in central Illinois. And that's nothing to be afraid of. And that's why I consistently say to the Midwest, hold yourselves up. You really are examples of how America can get it right. And I just want to give the Midwest kind of its power back.
That's Maria Hinojosa talking with GLT's Mary Cullen about being a Latina journalist amidst immigrant fear in the U.S. Hinojosa was the keynote speaker at the Latino Cultural Dinner at Illinois State University last night.
On the next Radio Lab, what's going on inside our guts?
25 feet of coiled, soiled, fetid tubing.
Corned beef.
Meat and bread and coffee.
Salt.
Pastrami sandwich.
Mini burgers.
It's steamy.
I don't know, it's like bubbly.
Well, kind of disgusting.
But fascinating.
Thousands of species that are living inside of you and preying on each other.
The mysteries of the human gut, this week on Radiolab. Listen Sunday at 11 on GLT News and Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from CEFQ, partnering with car dealers throughout central Illinois to make the auto loan process quick and convenient. Competitive rates for qualified buyers. Online pre-approval is available. CEFQ, not a bank, better. Details at CEFQ.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
West African musician Cheikh Amala Diabate says being a griot means his music is intricately intertwined with many disciplines, including history, storytelling, and even counseling. The now resident of Washington, D.C., travels the country to share the oral history, music, and song of his culture, passed on to him from birth by his parents. He'll play a concert with his band at Illinois Wesleyan University Saturday at 5:30 in the Memorial Center Main Lounge. Last August, GLT's John Norton caught up with Cheikh Amala Diabate by phone from his home in D.C. He says the griot traditional songs incorporate family names dating back hundreds of years to distinguish the storyteller within the history of the family.
For example, we have a song called Sunjata Keita. Sunjata Keita is the empire of Mali. But when you say your last name Keita, the griot can say Keita, Keita, Narem Ramandenka, Jack Makabala Simbo, Tontan Jontan Morokalafa, Jonani Suba Jata Wali. And that time you hear from your ancestor to you. If you say Traore family, Traore is a Tromga, and it can get a Moke Musu, and it can get down to my Bamana Fabaco Masa Bamana Jabaco Masaku, Muri Bantra Mama Banyalo, Tambai Bantra Mama Banyalo Kusri, and Kasne 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 Sasile Fabre Danka Fabre, Maranta Fi, and Maranta J. It's a thousand family. I know all from my family. We learn from father learned from the grandfather, the son learned from the father.
So those were all different family names you just ripped off.
All the last name in West Africa, Mali, if you tell me your last name, I tell you who you are.
Ah, okay.
That's because I told you it's very important. And the griot always singing, if I say important, sometimes I like to tell you something. If you do good, like you work every day, go to work, you work very hard, and your life is good. You get a baby, like a, you have a children, and those children grow up, they're going to say, oh, let me just lay down because my father have everything. The griot tell you to be careful. You got to work like your father do.
We're listening to the music of Cheikh Amala Diabate on GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. Your initial instrument and a traditional instrument in West Africa and Mali is the ngoni, which is very similar to a banjo, American banjo. The banjo in America is basically a descendant of the ngoni or some very similar instrument?
Yes, that's a very good history and very important history. Since I've been here, I've been working with a lot of banjo players in America. Because before I came here, I heard the American banjo came from the Goni. The Goni is the ancestor of the American banjo. And that time, I put Goni music and banjo music together. And this combination take us to the Grammy Award 2007. I was so happy to be in Los Angeles with all these big artists and they were walking to the red carpet. When I get back, I was, my country was so excited because I get a lot of interview from everywhere, from Europe, from Africa, from here. And this make me more happy to progress my music more. And that time I was with Bob Carlin from North Carolina, because him and me, we are, the album is from Mali to America. So we've been nominated for the Grammy 2007, and I was so very, very happy.
Washington, D.C. from Mali in 1995, so over 20 years ago now. I want to make sure I understand this. So when you moved to America, that was a personal decision, or was it more of an extension of the government, that the Mali government? That
actually, no. Not, it wasn't just, you know, people. I told you, since I was a baby, I have my uncle come to America. And they play music. Sometimes they come here for concert. People invite them. It can be like, I play in Howard University when I first come. It's not about the government. Sometimes some people like the ensemble instrumental, they are for the government, because the government send them to travel, do a lot of music, and they are... Every month they get like money, but some griots just travel like doing the concert, go to everywhere from Japan, China, people invite, and America, they come to play music, and I'm here like that, you know.
Okay.
I get invite, come to do the concert, and yeah.
Listening to the music of Sheikh Hamala Diabate on GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. We're also talking with the man behind the music. I get the sense, listening to you and what your mission is, that the different arts in Africa, I don't know if it's just traditionally or if that carries on today, whether it's music and dance and storytelling and poetry, they're all connected. I mean, it's like there is no separation. They are connected, and that's the way it is. Unlike in America, where music and dance and that can be connected, but they're considered different disciplines.
I mean, so important, even here now, we live here, how many company from here, the African-American, they have a lot of company, dance company, music company, they do like in West Africa. And they each understand each other. This music make them very, very strong. And they have a good education. Like I live here in Washington. Many different group here, but they do respect this culture. And this music teach them to be understand life. Because America is very different to West Africa. When I play this music with my friend Bob Carlin, this is Sheikh. So what name are we going to give to album? I say, okay, we're going to give from Mali to America, because I bring my culture here to sell with American people. So I teach them. They learn something from me, and I learn something from them. You know, and this culture grew up like, Bella Flag went to Mali, my family, to check and go learn this music. Bella Flag is a very good musician. Anywhere he play, it's like the musician play, give the message to people all the world. Anywhere you go, people are ready to listen to your music. And this music, since they like, bring them some peace and to be understand life. That's the music is very important.
West African musician Sheikh Hamala Diabate speaking with GLT's John Norton. The native of Mali plays Saturday at 5:30 in the Memorial Center Main Lounge of Illinois Wesleyan University. You can discover more local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, improvisational jazz-based bands have become two of the bigger musical draws in the Twin Cities. John Norton has that report as well. The October hearings of now Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh and his alleged assault of Christine Blasey Ford stirred up nationwide support for sexual assault victims. Illinois State University Associate Professor of Criminal Justice Shelley Clevenger says the hearings likely also brought unwanted memories for past victims of sexual assault. Clevenger speaks with GLT's Mary Cullen about her research into the victimization of sexual assault survivors.
Much of your research looked into the types of victimization sexual assault survivors experience. You suggest the first victimization is the physical act of the assault. The second is the survivor's interactions with law enforcement and medical personnel. And the third is online victimization. Can you explain what exactly you mean by online victimization?
Survivors of sexual assault often are victimized online in a variety of different ways. And so this is often by the perpetrator and the perpetrator's friends and family, but it can also just be by regular sort of people in the public. And they can be cyber-stalked. They can experience cyber harassment and threats. They can also experience sextortion, which is where I would try to extort money or sexual favors from you in exchange for money or to not send pictures. And then also revenge pornography, where I'm going to post pictures and also personal information online. They also can experience hacking into their personal files or webcams, and identity theft, where the perpetrator is actually using their identity to open up credit cards or mortgages in their names, which some of the survivors that I interviewed had experienced multiple different types of cyber victimizations after their sexual victimizations. And they have said that this was worse than their in-person victimizations because it never went away. The internet is always on and our lives are very much ingrained in technology. And so this third victimization that they are experiencing oftentimes was the worst.
Like you were saying, when it goes online, it's kind of there forever. So then how do we as a society combat this online victimization?
First, to not support these sorts of things. So revenge pornography, in order for it to be, you know, disseminated, people need to want to see it. So if somebody sent you these sorts of images or you know that revenge pornography sites exist, don't look at the images, don't go to the sites. Also, I think supporting survivors. So if people tell you that they have been victimized in this way online, my first thing I would say is just believe them and ask what they need or what you could do for them. And also don't add fuel to it. And so one of the things that's often really hard for survivors is if their story is online. So if it's on a newspaper article or someone has, you know, put the police report online, don't make the negative comments. Don't engage in the victim blaming. Don't try on purpose to make people feel bad on the internet.
You recently spoke in Washington, D.C. on the Enough Act. That's a measure prohibiting the non-consensual distribution of sexually explicit photos and videos. Can you tell us a bit about that visit?
I was really honored and privileged to go and talk about the Enough Act, which I'm hoping gets passed, because right now we have no federal legislation against non-consensual pornography or revenge pornography. And I really feel that if we want this to be taken seriously, because it is a serious crime, that we need to have federal legislation. And so going and speaking was really great because you were talking to the people who actually have the power to implement or change this law. And I got to speak my opinion. And so I felt really just excited that I got that opportunity. Most people don't get to do that. And so I advocated for harsher punishments for offenders because this often has a lifelong impact on survivors. And the Enough Act currently says 5 years is the max punishment. And I felt that 5 years is not harsh enough for the things that survivors experience. And I also talked about changes in how they have distribute or also what they mean by the images that are being shared, because one of the things that perpetrators can do is actually take your face, the survivor's face, and put it on a body of someone else or a digitally created body, but it still has the same devastating impact because people would believe that that's your naked body. So I went and talked about all of my recommendations, and I got to network and meet a lot of people. And so it was truly a once-in-a-lifetime experience.
So the Enough Act is currently held up in committee. I'm assuming that's where you spoke. Is that correct?
We did a congressional briefing, and so we invited policymakers, their staffers. We also had special interest type groups like the Department of Defense was there, and Violence Against Women International. And so we had the people who are, I don't know how else to say it, but the movers and shakers of D.C. there, who would have power to push the Enough Act.
It still hasn't been sent to the floor. Why do you think that is? And then after that, what can be done in the meantime while that bill is still held up?
So I think that it has not been sent forward because revenge pornography or non-consensual pornography is not something that I think a lot of people care enough about. And I think the reason over the years of studying this is because people often blame the victim for this. So people will say, oh, well, if you don't want naked pictures of you out there, don't share naked pictures with someone. And so there's a lot of victim blaming associated with this, which I think is very unfair because no one would share these sorts of images with someone if they thought they would then make them public or use them to hurt them.
So now let's go back to the second victimization, which was the survivor's interactions with law enforcement and medical personnel. Can you explain to listeners how those experiences can be victimizing?
Survivors oftentimes have less than great experiences when they go to report to police or they go to the hospitals. And so with police, oftentimes they feel that they're being blamed. And it might not be that they're being blamed, but it might be the way that the police are asking the question. So the police are trying to gather evidence. They're trying to get material to build the case. And sometimes the survivors feel that they're not handling those cases with care, and especially if they're in a traumatized state. They often feel that they're being re-victimized. And also having to tell their story over and over again to multiple law enforcement or in court, that can be very hard for them, and they feel re-victimized. In terms of going to the hospital or with medical personnel, they also feel blamed because of some of the questioning that they ask or the way that they ask the questions. Or we have a lack of sexual assault nurse examiners. And so those are professionals who would be trained with how to handle survivors of sexual assault. So they oftentimes are just going to the emergency room or their family care physician, and they don't know how to handle sexual assault cases. And so I've had many survivors talk about the bad experiences they've had. And I think that it's mostly from lack of education or lack of training with how to deal with survivors.
Now, moving forward, I know Illinois actually passed a law this past session about increasing the number of sexually assault trained nurses in hospitals across the state. What else can be done either by law enforcement or by medical professionals to cause less of a trauma on these victims?
I think that it's important when law enforcement are interacting with people who have been victimized that they realize that everybody is different. And that's often, you know, hard for us because people are reacting in ways that we wouldn't react. But to understand that trauma impacts people differently, to be understanding of someone's victimization, and also to be supportive. The thing that I would like to see, if I could have any change, would be that law enforcement have a lot of empathy towards survivors, and that they also would provide them with resources that could help them, not just with the criminal case, but help them cope and help them move forward.
GLT's Mary Cullen speaking with ISU Associate Professor of Criminal Justice Sciences, Shelley Clevenger. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Two instrumental, improvisational, jazz-based bands have become two of the bigger musical draws in the Twin Cities over the last couple years. Both are on the bill at Night Shop in downtown Bloomington tomorrow night in a benefit for the Bloom Community School in Normal. Tommy O'Donnell of Ink Trail and Stefan Robinson of Disorganizer join John Norton in the GLT studios for a talk about the music of both bands and why these instrumental bands have become two of the most popular draws in the Twin Cities.
We're skeptical of that statement.
I mean...
Tommy's blushing.
I like singer-songwriters, too.
Tough one right out of the
chute. I can tell you that Disorganizer is just darn good. When I saw him, I'm like, well, I'm going back. I will go see that band again.
Why? This is Tommy speaking
the
now.
The appreciation of... They're good players. They write great songs. And you don't always need lyrics to get a point across.
You know, and if I can say something about Ink Trail, whenever I see Ink Trail play at my... jaw drops. All three of those dudes are virtuosic in their ability on their particular instruments.
Usually there's slobber dripping from the side of my mouth. So my jaw's kind of dropping anyway.
So you guys are probably the wrong people to ask then about why two instrumental improvisational bands are really lighting it up here in Bloomington Normal.
Yeah, I don't know. I would ask someone who's in the audience more, but there's clubs now that'll support it, and I guess we just keep trying. As long as we keep trying to play, people will come. You know, and there's history with both bands. Being in other bands, it probably doesn't hurt either.
Yeah.
John Ganser and I...
Well, you guys are in like 40 different bands together, right?
We are. We've been playing music, when writing music since... we actually went to high school together and used to pass each other in the hall, and we didn't really know each other, and we joined the Something Brothers when we were about 21. We were the young guys, and really since then we've been writing music. We did the Spelunkers in the 90s, and so he and I cannot stop being around each other and composing and putting together.
Let's talk about Ganser. John Ganser, he's a monster drummer.
God's own drummer.
What does he bring to the table?
He's a musical drummer, and I know that sounds counterintuitive, because you think, okay, drumming's a rhythm instrument, but a musical drummer knows more about what you're doing than you do. Like John, he's the first guy to say, you know what, I think you're a half step off on that melody, or can you do it more like this way? Like he's really thinking about everyone's role, certainly not getting in the way of what you're coming up with, but he's just a musical drummer. As I think Michael is for Disorganizer.
It's Michael Carlson, yeah.
The first time I saw Ganser play was with Ken
Thornton. Who's,
yeah. What was it? They all wore suits.
Von Frickle.
Yes, Frickle.
Oh, that's another legendary
so
band.
So maybe we should. They're kind of the impetus for instrumental rock around here. God,
yeah, Von Frickle.
Getting popular.
They blew my mind.
Yeah, they're great.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Why? This is Stefan, though.
I mean, I was in this kind of like hybrid bluegrass band at the time in Bloomington. And I saw Von Frickle at, like, the Lizard's Lounge or something like that. I didn't expect to see something like that in Bloomington, Illinois. And they were exceptional. And it was weird and spacey and tight. And the compositions were cool.
Yeah.
And the drumming was
phenomenal.
Out of this world.
They were definitely more on the proggier side of things than, say, Ink Trail is.
It's the music of Ink Trail at Night Shop earlier this summer. This is GLT's Sound Ideas in studio with Ink Trail's Tommy O'Donnell and Stefan Robinson with Disorganizer. Both bands on the bill Friday night at Night Shop. It's a benefit for the Bloom School.
That's correct.
Both bands, improvisational instrumental bands. Stefan, you write lyrics with Yay Big. Tommy, you're with the Something Brothers, and there's lyrics in that band. Stefan, what can you do with Disorganizer without lyrics? To get an emotion across, get an idea across.
Let me try to answer that in an indirect way.
Okay.
A while back, we played the Midwest Punk Fest, and Chris from Night Shop invited us to play that. There weren't a whole lot of political bands at the Punk Fest. I said, how come there aren't more political bands here? And his answer to me was, Well, I got to pick a few bands, and the political band I picked was Disorganizer. And I was like, we don't have lyrics. And
he, was his tongue planted firmly in his cheek when he said
he was dead serious. I don't remember the words he used to express it, but he's like, your music like bleeds your politics. I guess that's true. Apparently, we said something with our instrumental music to at least Chris that spoke revolution.
He was fist in the air when he said that.
It's definitely a frenetic energy. When I see you guys, there's an energy there, like a that you can't really put a finger on it. I mean, the whole human race, when we listen to music, you're going to focus on something. And if the lyrics aren't there and the singing's not there, if you still have a good melody and a lead instrument that's taking over, your mind is going to focus on that. Like it's going to develop something in your mind that's going to bring a visualization, a political thing, whatever. Your mind is going to focus on something that's going to make it entertaining for you.
So as a guitarist and a lyricist, if you're just doing guitar, is there an emotion that you can get across?
Absolutely.
Without lyrics?
It's still the same focus. You want to just make it good as you can make it, you know. But I think you can definitely get emotional across. When you listen to John Coltrane, I turn it up and I tell everyone to be quiet so I can listen and develop something in my mind as I listen, you know.
The fundamental truth of the universe can't be expressed with language, you know, spoken language, I don't think. It's pre-language. Language is reactionary in a sense. And I think playing music more closely, it's the closest thing I know personally that gets me to expressing reality.
That's putting a finer point on it. He just took what I said and made it way better.
Disorganizer, recorded at Knapp House Studios this summer. This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton, in studio with Disorganizer Stefan Robinson, as well as Tommy O'Donnell of Inktrail, both on the bill at Night Shop in downtown Bloomington Friday night. It's a benefit for the Bloom School. All right, I want to turn this over to you guys right now, and I'll start with Tommy. What is a question you would like to ask Stefan about Disorganizer? Let me preface this by saying when we decided to bring both of them in for the interview, both of them were like, it was like a love fest. Oh, I love Disorganizer. Oh, I love Inktrail. Oh, so there's a mutual admiration society going on here.
The question I think I've asked Stefan before is, did they listen to the Mahavishnu Orchestra? Because when I hear the mandolin mixed with the saxophone, I get that late 60s, early 70s, anything goes vibe. Now, I don't get a political vibe when I listen to Disorganizer. Maybe I'll think about that next time I see them. I get like this frenetic energy, and it's really because of the two strings on the mandolin, it's sort of shaky, and I don't know how to explain it. So my question would be, did you guys listen to a lot of early 70s sort of prog rock?
I mean, we all listen to so much different music. I definitely listened to the Mahavishnu Orchestra when I was in high school and ate that stuff up. And then I studied Indian classical music for a half a year or so with a sitar player in Chicago.
Wow.
And I was doing it on the mandolin.
Now you say that, I can hear that.
And I played for a while with a local tabla player, Manny Betty, who teaches tabla in the community. We played some festivals,
Fantastic.
Indian music festivals.
Musical diversity at its finest.
I know the other dudes in Disorganizer listen to just about everything as well, you know.
Yeah.
So
I wouldn't doubt it. I mean, going back to your instrumental music being, how is it popular? When guys listen to everything from, like you said, we started out with singer-songwriters. We like that.
Yeah.
We also like The Residents, you know, and everything in between.
And I think probably this is true of Tommy. I'm equally influenced by the most abrasive atonal punk or noise music as I am Coltrane, or as I am, you know, computer improvisations where people are designing patches in software to just manipulate samples. I find all of that the same.
I'm kind of the same way. In fact, I listen to more punk rock than I do just about anything. 1977 to 1980 is just my favorite everything that was going on was great.
Well, Stephan Robinson of Disorganizer, you get the last question. What do you want to ask Tommy O'Donnell of Ink Trail that you've always wanted to ask him?
The first thing that pops into my mind is, what are your major non-musical influences to your music? Because I come at it from not just being influenced by music, but, you know, like politics and economics. And do you have something outside of music that is equally influential to your music as other people's music?
Oh, wow. Interesting question. Never even thought about it.
Could be literature, could be theater, could be science.
Yeah. I grew up being kind of an athlete. And
Really?
I never...
What'd you play? What sports?
Like football and basketball.
I'm not pegging you as an athlete.
I don't
mean that disparagingly. I'm pegging you as an artsy fartsy musician.
Those things aren't mutually exclusive.
I know. I mean, I'm the same way. I was an athlete growing up too.
I was an honorable all-state tailback. Not tailback. What's the safety at Bloomington High School?
Wow.
My point is, I think I always approached music with a little bit of that athletic mind, like, hey, the longer you do it, the better you get at it. Don't give up. All those, like, poster quotes that you see on, you know, inspirational quotes. That's sort of how I've approached music. In that way, I always, where's the guitar? I got to play it today. I got to have it in my hands.
Tommy O'Donnell of Ink Trail and Stephan Robinson of Disorganizer spoke with GLT's John Norton. Both bands play Night Shop in downtown Bloomington tomorrow night in a benefit for Bloom Community School in Normal. Discover more local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it at NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Thanks to Ryan Denham, Mary Cohen, and John Norton today. I'm Charlie Schlenker.